Hello everybody and welcome back to the Damage Report. I'm John Arola. It's Wednesday, also Gordon Sondland testimony day, which we'll get to soon. But before that, J.R. Jackson.
I'm willing to hand over the reins of J.R. Wednesday to Gordon Wednesdays, just for this morning.
It's GD Wednesdays, yes. And you know that it's a debate day because J.R. Jackson wearing a very nice jacket.
Well, this was, you know what, Edwin working over here with us. He was like, oh, what's up the suit coat jacket? And I was like, listen, man, on a long day like this, when I'm gonna be doing this, the main show, and then also the debate coverage as well, you wanna have an interchangeable comfort zone. So honestly, what I'm wearing is a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And then I can take it off, this jacket off, and be wearing a t-shirt and be comfortable.
Yeah, that is nice after the show.
So actually, it's a bit of a dress down than normal.
Okay, I take away all the credit I was giving.
Thank you.
Both stated and implicit. But anyway, as you alluded to, not only are you gonna be on the main show, which is gonna be great, but also the big debate in Georgia is happening tonight. It is gonna be a huge one. And so after the debate, come back to TYT. We're gonna do a pre-show too, but after the debate, come back to TYT where JR, myself, Anna, and Ida are gonna be doing debate analysis because it's gonna be huge. But with that, we got tons of stuff to get to, and so much so that I'm not gonna give you a preview. Just, you know, you've already started listening, just keep going. Do you really wanna click pause at this point? Anyway, so let's jump into the news. Today was in the impeachment hearings, the big day where Gordon Sondland, the guy who initially said no quid pro quo, and then slightly adjusted that to definitely quid pro quo testified. Now, before we get to the videos, we have a bunch of awesome videos of Gordon Sondland testifying. I want you to know what sort of person Gordon Sondland is. Not from my point of view, but from Donald Trump's point of view. Back in October, he said, I would love to send Ambassador Sondland, a really good man and great American, to testify. But unfortunately, he would be testifying before a totally compromised kangaroo court, which he had to be convinced did not involve actual livestock. But anyway, so he thought, good man, great American. Keep that in the back of your mind as we continue through this and when Donald Trump gives his evaluation of Sondland today. But let's go to the first video. Some of the most important simple points made by Sondland. Here's a big one.
I know that members of this committee frequently frame these complicated issues in the form of a simple question. Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes.
That seems pretty simple.
This is hearsay, John. This is from third hand accounts. This is from playing telephone. This is from a can and a string. Mm-hmm. They keep going with the same thing. Even last week when they were saying, this is third party information. These people didn't know the president. These people weren't working with the president. These people didn't hear directly what the president said. I was like, just keep waiting. Because this is a collection of evidence.
Yeah.
A multitude of witnesses that are saying what happened. And then when they want to ask their own witnesses, again, many times Republican House side wants to say, well, this person didn't agree.
Yeah.
Well, now that's like their opinion.
Yeah, exactly. And look, they kept saying second, third hand information. So Gordon Sondland was directly talking with Trump. He was directly talking with Zelensky and his aides. But here's the thing, what it's really important that you understand that it's not just that the argument that the GOP says we've only been getting second, third and fourth hand information. It's not just that that's inaccurate. It's that they are lying to you and they don't care. Gordon Sondland was directly involved in these conversations. They don't care what he said. Right now, they're very glad to say that Zelensky didn't feel pressured, even though reporting indicates that he very much did. But if Zelensky came out with a press conference today and said, yes, it was clearly a quid pro quo, they wouldn't be using that talking point anymore. They would simply jettison Zelensky into the middle of the sun. They wouldn't care. It is so fake. And I know that that makes it really frustrating to follow along with this, where we're supposed to pretend that, you know, there's people on one side and they believe one thing, there's people on another and they just disagree. No, some people are trying to get to the bottom of whether a crime was committed, whether impeachment is merited, and others are lying to protect their power. It's really as simple as that.
If you want to think about it fully, you've got, again, these numerous witnesses that are confirming the same thing from different angles. So it's not even just the same story, it's different angles from different points of view that are confirming the same outcome and the reasoning for them getting to that. And the one person who said it that is not the way it is the guy that they're accusing of it. Mm-hmm. So if you have all these witnesses and then the one guy who's being accused of it said, I didn't do it, that's your basis?
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah, now here's the thing, Sondland, he's the big guy today, but he's not the only one hypothetically that could have increased exposure after this testimony. We can't go through all of what he said about a multitude of other people in the Trump administration, but here is one quote where he managed to tie in multiple people.
Officials in the State Department and the Chiefs of Staff's office, including Mick Mulvaney, Secretary Pompeo were aware of this quid pro quo, that in order to get the White House meeting, there were going to have to be these investigations the president wanted.
Correct.
And those, again, are investigations into 2016 and Burisma / the Bidens.
2016 Burisma. The Bidens did not come up.
But you would ultimately learn that Burisma meant the Bidens when you saw the call record, correct?
Of course. Today I know exactly what it means.
So Mulvaney, Pompeo, at some point he also talks about conversations he had with Mike Pence as well. So he really was not only a firsthand source of information for Donald Trump and Zelensky, but for virtually everyone else at the top of the Trump administration on this.
So the only thing left after this is to say how he's a never-Trumper, how he hates Donald Trump from the beginning. He's been trying to get this guy out of office. He's working with Adam Schiff. Who is this guy again?
Mm-hmm.
How much did he donate?
I don't know if it's just to the,
was it the campaign or the inauguration?
Inauguration,
fund?
Yeah.
Because once his candidate was in office, he donated $1 million for his inauguration fund because he hates him that much.
Exactly, yeah.
Hey, I wish he hated me that much.
Yeah. Shower me with some of your hate. So look, there's more big important stuff to get to, but let's just take a brief intermission for one of the fun moments that came up in the middle of all this.
Well, he also testified that you confirmed to President Trump that you were in Ukraine at the time and that President Zelensky, quote, loves your ass, unquote. Do you recall saying that?
Yeah, it sounds like something I would say. That's how President Trump and I communicate, a lot of four-letter words. In this case, three-letter.
That laugh. But so anyway, so that was fun, and that was a big quote that came out last week. Mm-hmm. And so look, we don't have necessarily direct references to a lot of stuff outside of the text messages and everything, but that was a great one. But anyway, to get back to the really important information, the actual specific nature of what Donald Trump wanted, that is something that I have been trying to be very clear on. And that also came out, I'll give you more details in a minute, but that also came up with Sondland, as you'll see here.
He had to get those two investigations if that official act was going to take place, correct?
He had to announce the investigations. He didn't actually have to do them, as I understood it.
That is like the most important thing for a couple of different reasons. You look like you want to talk. You can go first. You first.
So it's such an illustration of the way Donald Trump has always worked. We don't actually need anything concrete. We don't need any meat to this. We don't need the investigation to actually come up with anything to convict anyone or even to put them on blast. All I need is for it to look a certain way. Mm-hmm. As much as he talks about central casting and he wants this thing to look a certain way, he's a reality show host. That's who he is. He's a faker. He creates this veneer, and then you're supposed to believe what's going on. So he's like, it's too much work to make you guys, hey, President of Ukraine, I don't want you to actually do much work. Just say you did it so he can help me out.
Yeah. And so think about Crooked Hillary. That was every 3 seconds during the 2016 campaign, he was saying that. How much concrete evidence did he need to provide to his base to make that narrative stick? None at all, really. Yeah. And with Biden, what does he need? He needs Fareed Zakaria to be interviewing the Ukrainian president, which was scheduled, and for him to say, I'm looking into Joe Biden and this corruption, and that would be it. Yeah. The Ukrainian president could then go home. We would not need him anymore for the rest of the campaign. Trump would say, crooked Biden, for the rest of it. That's all it is. But what's really even more important there is the obvious understanding that there's nothing to be found. It's not that Trump actually believes this conspiracy theory involving Joe Biden, and he thinks, man, if we really dig into this, it's just gonna keep reaping these rewards. He doesn't care if there's anything there, and he suspects that there's not. That's why he wants the announcement. If he actually cared about corruption, whether just weirdly for Joe Biden or for Ukraine in general, he would need actual investigations. That's what he would need to get to the bottom of it. There's no bottom he's looking for there. He dwells at the bottom, okay? And the bottom is just plausible deniability to start a narrative about crooked Joe Biden. That's all it is. And that's what this quid pro quo is about. It is about justifying his campaign strategy. It has nothing to do with actual corruption, which Donald Trump not only doesn't care about in the US or internationally, but engages in every way that he possibly can. And it certainly doesn't have to do with Ukrainian corruption. He doesn't care about that at all. He doesn't know anything about Ukraine.
Not at all.
It was about an announcement that he would be able to play over and over in campaign ads and that he would reference in his rally speeches. That's it.
And this is galvanizing the fact that even though this has turned up nothing on the Bidens, is he specifically for any kind of corruption based? And sure, I mean, a name can get someone a job. But look at the way that he's also pursuing this even without that announcement. Mm-hmm. Corrupt these Bidens. Imagine if President Zelensky had actually said so. Mm. Hey, you know, we're going to launch this investigation into the Bidens. That's all he wanted. Mm-hmm. And he didn't even get that, and he's still doing it. So imagine if he got it.
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah. At the end of the day, like he sure wanted Zelensky to go on Fried's Gari and say that. And again, the only reason that didn't happen is because this whole thing blew up. And then the aid was very quickly released. They keep pretending that those two things aren't true. Right. But he's probably still going to run on it anyway. It doesn't even matter. So with that, why don't we turn to Donald Trump and his reaction? We actually got a little bit of that earlier today.
I just noticed one thing, and I would say, that means it's all over. What do you want from Ukraine? He asks me, screaming. What do you want from Ukraine? I keep hearing all these different ideas and theories. This is Ambassador Sondland speaking to me. Just happened. To which I turned off the television. What do you want from Ukraine? I keep hearing all these different ideas and theories. What do you want? What do you want? It was a very short and abrupt conversation that he had with me. They said he was not in a good mood. I'm always in a good mood. I don't know what that is. He just said, now he's talking about what my response. So he's going, what do you want? What do you want? I hear all these theories. What do you want? Right? And now here's my response that he gave, just gave. Ready? You have the cameras rolling? I want nothing. That's what I want from Ukraine. That's what I said. I want nothing. I said it twice.
I want nothing. Now, okay, lest you think that he was doing his normal thing where he sort of ad-libs in the middle of a speech. As always, Donald Trump takes notes. Here's a shot of his actual notes from this morning. This is not Photoshop, this is real. You can see in big Sharpie, I want nothing, I want nothing, I want no quid pro quo. That's definitely what he said in the conversation. I want no quid pro quo. Tell Zelensky to do the right thing, which sort of undercuts what he's saying there. This is the final word from the President of the United States. He would not have remembered any of that if 20 minutes before he had not Sharpied it in big letters. And why does it have to be in Sharpie? Because he's an incredibly vain person. He needs glasses, but he won't wear them because he thinks it makes him look weak. So that's just a pathetic little side note to all of this. But I want nothing. I want nothing.
He wants nothing. He wants nothing from Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just now, now you want nothing from Ukraine. This entire time you've been saying how the reason you did all this is because you want to root out corruption in Ukraine.
So what happened to that? What happened to the cover story even?
Is corruption nothing?
I don't know. And look, that was a September. So he believes that's we're done with this whole thing because according to Sondland, that's a conversation that he had. Now, Sondland is not saying Trump didn't want anything. He's saying, and it was very clear, Trump told me he didn't want anything. When? On September 9th. Not, you know, in June, July, when all this is going on. After the whole scandal is out, they have a conversation where Sondland is like, what is going on? And Trump's like, I don't want anything. I want no quid pro quo. Who is that convincing that you didn't actually want anything months later? Like, dude, you kept the aid for months. You wouldn't release it. This is not convincing anyone.
It's convincing himself. That's
maybe,
the only person that matters.
Maybe. Those notes, geez. It just seems weird and flailing. And there, we sort of had predicted this, but Gordon Sondland, a guy who was big Trump supporter, so much so that he wrote him a check for $1 million and was handed an ambassadorship, which is a whole different form of corruption that we're totally okay with, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. What did Trump have to say about him? So he says that he doesn't know him very well. Oh, we don't have the tweet anymore. Unfortunately, I cut it away. But he says, I don't know him. Seems like a good guy. He actually supported other candidates. He supported other people, not me, but that's okay.
This was this morning?
Yes, this morning said, in that speech. I should have kept the video,
no
but
lie.
I didn't think we'd have time.
I was
yes, gonna, he said, I don't know him very well. I just talked to him constantly and chose him to deal with a country that I believe the corruption, that rooting it out is super important. So I chose this guy that I don't know, that I've previously said is a good man and a great American, but I said that not knowing him.
This morning he just said, we talked together. Sondland said, hey, we use 3 and 4 letter words all the time.
It was 20, no, I really should have just kept the video. It was like 20 seconds after what you just saw that he goes off about how he doesn't know him.
No, literally, I was gonna joke and say the next step is to say, I don't know him. The way he says it, everyone else. I never met Jennifer Williams. I don't know who this Bill Taylor is. I don't know them. I don't
Depends
know them.
Who.
Who knows who they are? By the way, it doesn't matter if you know them or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They know what you were doing.
They do know, and you do know him. Jeez. God, write it in Sharpie so we'll remember next time. Okay, so that was Trump's immediate reaction. We'll see. I mean, the testimony is still going on. That's our last word on it. But on the main show on the Young Turks later today, they'll have more, obviously. We'll see if Trump will have weighed in more. So we're going to take a short break. We come back. A candidate is going to be joining us on the other side.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, you must unlearn what you have learned. And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joining us now is a congressional candidate for New York's 6th District, Mel Gagarin. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. So talk to me about this race. We love to, whenever we have a candidate on, especially for the first time, we want to get to know a little bit about their background, how they got involved in a run for Congress. So tell us about yourself.
Sure. Right now, I'm a stay-at-home dad. I'm raising 3 children with my wife here in Kew Gardens, Queens. I entered the sort of political world when I came to New York back in like 2006. I was born and raised here in Queens, but I went to school down at American University. I worked for an organization there called the National Foundation for Women Legislators for a bit before I came to New York. I worked for New York State Senator Jose Serrano, Congressman Anthony Weiner. I ran for city council actually in 2009. Once that didn't work out, I thought I was done with electoral politics, decided I really wanted to focus on specific issues that I cared about. I worked for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, a short stint at Planned Parenthood in New York City, and then I went to the public policy advocacy space, working at the intersection of criminal justice reform, higher education, and women's rights, before I stepped back to do the stay-at-home dad bit. But you know, after 2016, it was sort of hard to ignore what was happening in the country and slowly worked my way back into the electoral world, sort of inspired by AOC, being a field lead on the Tiffany Caban campaign, and you know, sort of seeing that the energy and the movement that we have going on here in New York really inspired me to stand up for my community and take on the incoming congresswoman.
Yeah, and so look, as you just described, I mean, despite not holding public office, you have more of a history than a lot of the candidates that we talk to, and you're in an area that, as you point out, is sort of a hotbed for these sorts of candidacies, people like AOC, Tiffany Caban as well. And so tell me about this district, because you're running for the 6th district. There is an incumbent as well as a couple of other candidates who are running. So give us a little lay of the actual district and your competition.
Sure. So I think that one of the things that I find really special about my district is that it's the only congressional district in New York City that encompasses, you know, it's made up entirely of Queens. So it's incredibly diverse. Over 51% of our community members are foreign born. So odds are, if you're not an immigrant yourself, you're the child of one, like I am. My father immigrated here from the Philippines when he was 19. You know, my mom was the child of two Puerto Rican parents who came here to sort of start a better life. So it's an incredibly diverse, both you know, racially, economically, and yeah, you know, that it's the sort of the hotbed of sort of this progressive movement that we see happening throughout the country. I think, because I think 2020 is a very special year for progressive challengers like myself.
Okay. And in terms of your platform, there are a number of things that you propose that a lot of our viewers are probably familiar with at this point, including Medicare for All, Green New Deal, Free College for All, Housing for All. But you also have this proposal, the Golden Years Security Act, that I'm actually not familiar with. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So that was sort of inspired by seeing what my grandparents went through in their end of life years. So I was raised primarily by my mom, who was a single mom and a nurse. She worked the night shift pretty much till she retired 3 years ago. And when my grandparents entered their final years and had gotten ill, between my wife and my mom, we had a support network that was able to take care of them. Luckily, we had insurance because of my mom, but you know, seeing what my grandmother went through after her surgery, where she was at a rehab facility for seniors, and seeing the nursing staff overworked and understaffed, led my wife and I having to sort of pick up some of the slack and, you know, bring in gauze to help change her wounds and clean her wounds and whatnot. And it really opened up my eyes to seeing the struggle that a lot of our elders face, even with Medicare, even with Medicaid, even with Social Security. And until we have Medicare for All, those gaps are going to continue to exist. And so what I wanted to do was think of some type of policy that would help fill in those gaps so that we can make sure that our elders are not facing their golden years in economic insecurity. You know, this would require moving or transitioning our elder care services and nationalizing those. That also means we have more accountability, that we're able to create better paying union jobs for our nursing staff, and making sure that, you know, whether it's home care services, because not every state covers home care services for our elders, that if a family needs to make a choice about assisted living for a loved one, that financial burden isn't solely on those folks, that we are able to step in and take care of that for people.
Well, that sounds like a great idea. And honestly, it's not something that I hear much conversation about in congressional races or even, you know, in the Democratic primary. You don't hear much of a focus on it. And especially even like pragmatically, it's a big voting block. And it seems odd that it gets so little attention at a national level. And so, you know, good on you for focusing on it. If people want to find out more about your candidacy and your platform, where should they go to get that information?
That's www.melforprogress.com.
Mel Gagarin, candidate in New York 6th District, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, lots more to get to. I was really surprised to see a series of tweets by a reporter for Axios, Alexi McCammon, who's previously appeared on the Damage Report, talking about an interaction that she had with Charles Barkley. Here is what she tweeted. Just FYI, Charles Barkley told me tonight, quote, "I don't hit women, but if I did, I would hit you." And then when I objected to that, he told me, quote, "I couldn't take a joke." So one of the reasons that I wanted to bring this up with you is not only because, you know, we've had Lexi on, she's a great reporter. It's horrendous for anyone to be making these sorts of jokes, let alone threats. But I also figure that you probably have more knowledge about Charles Barkley and his past than I do.
Not only Charles Barkley's past, but his present. He says whatever comes
to
his mind.
So he is known for just saying stuff.
Yeah, and you know, many times, you know, he's this guy who has gotten
Really fast. Yeah. That, by the way, is not intended in any way to diminish what he said. Mm-hmm. Just saying what is on your mind does not make what you say any less horrendous or threatening.
The thing is, I guess if it comes to the case of whether or not people believe it or not, this is one of those things where I think his persona, his personality, his character kind of matches up with this. Uh-huh. If you don't know it's there, because I guess
so you find it easy to believe.
Yeah, then. Yeah, okay. And you know, again, I don't know what provable case you can have to say he told her this. I'm not sure if he's even denying it. It seems like he's the type of person that wouldn't even deny it necessarily. Someone asked.
I don't doubt it for 1 second.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. And she's she went on to say there was almost no times I will break an off the record agreement, but this is not okay. And it was all because he came in talking about how he loves Deval Patrick. And once someone from Pete's campaign came around, he said he loved Pete. And I reminded him he previously said he was a Deval fan. So she just pointed out an inconsistency that in real time she noticed. And that, like, let's say from his point of view, if he really thinks that it's acceptable to make a joke about attacking a woman, that you would think that that was justified after she points out that you just said you like one candidate and now you're saying you like another one. I don't understand the thought process
which
of that at all.
Which seems like such a surface, not even criticism, but observation that she had about him. Mm-hmm. You know, when one guy's around, you say you support him. And then when another guy comes around, you say you support that guy. You kind of flow with whichever way the wind's blowing. Which I don't think is that much of an insulting thing to say, but kind of just pointing out. So maybe that could trigger him to think, I can say this flip, what he sees as a flippant thing, which is actually a pretty serious thing to say.
Yeah.
And he thinks it's just quipping back and forth.
Yeah.
Not the case.
Yeah, and I will just say, so when Alexi tweeted this out, many people who have previously worked or interacted with her, as I have, responded with something to the effect of, you know, I'm sorry you went through that, that's horrible, I can't even imagine that, something like that. So I tweeted something like that. And someone responded to me by finding a tweet of hers from 8 years ago that they thought made her look bad or something, and then just replied with that tweet. And I can't get into the brain of the person who replied that, but the idea that if a woman is threatened by a man, that she doesn't get to talk about that or feel threatened if she has ever said anything that you have a problem with is a very bizarre reaction to what was going on. And Charles Barkley is a full-grown man. He's more than a full-grown man at this point. He knows that this is 100% unacceptable. He wasn't just, you know, like unfrozen from the 60s or something. Not that would justify it, but this should be a very simple case of you obviously don't say something like this to a female reporter. She is right to feel threatened by it. And someone trying to do some sort of weird dodge by having an issue with her past comments is really bizarre. And that says a lot more about the person doing the tweeting than about her.
I assume the tweet that the person linked you to must have had her saying something like, I'm willing to hit anyone for disagreeing with me, something.
Well, specifically it said, I want to punch Charles Barkley. No, it had nothing to do with any of this. Yeah, so really bizarre. Anyway, Alexi's a good reporter. She should, by the way, she should not feel in any way bad about breaking an off-the-record agreement with Charles Barkley if he's saying stuff like this. This is not something that's protected under that sort of confidentiality. Anyway, let's turn to a very different sort of topic. I have a pet peeve, and it's I know it's weird in this industry, but I have a problem with people lying to other people. I just think it's weird when you lie for no reason. And we have had someone on the show, Judd Legum, who does great work in identifying the weird ways, the petty, odd ways that politicians lie, not to the people who oppose them, but to their supporters. And he's got a great example of it here. So he tweeted this out yesterday, saying it's amazing how casually the Trump campaign lies to its own supporters. And what he's referring to is a text message from Brad Parscale. He's the campaign manager for Donald Trump, who messaged out to everyone on the list or whatever, impeachment hoax. I meet with President Trump in 1 hour to show him the new donor list. Add your name, friend, donate $45 and a link to do that. And so look, we're gonna have more on this, but let's just take that. The idea that Brad Parscale is just like biding his time, waiting 50 minutes until lots of Trump lovers donate, and then he's going to crunch the numbers and print out a list of donors that he will march into Donald Trump, and then they will go over the list of donors. That's Alice in Wonderland type thinking. That's not true. And the thing is, that text doesn't go to me. It doesn't go to the resistance. It goes to Trump lovers and lies to them and say, if you donate now, Trump will see your name. The person you worship and look up to will see your name and know who you are on some level. And he's lying to those people who trust them.
This all matches up. We talked about earlier about how it matches up with this, like, this show style mentality and approach to doing politics, or even just reaching out for some supporters. In 1 hour, we're coming down. It's, if you watch, this is old school type of thing, but if you're watching late night TV and you'll see these ads or infomercials that pop on these channels because there's nothing else to show at 2 a.m., then they go, there's a countdown in the corner. Come get your new water hose that'll never break. It doesn't get any kinks.
Limited
you order
offer.
In the next 30 minutes and they do the rundown counter. You hurry up and do it now. That's the type of thing you do where you try and get this impulse buy. Oh my God, I better hurry up and do this. I'm not going to get my hose that doesn't kink up.
And that ad only plays once, right? It doesn't play every break over and over for months at a time. And the thing is, I'm very glad that you brought up that example because that's exactly what's happening here. It's one thing to try to trick people into thinking it's a limited time offer when you can literally get it anytime you want. That's the first text message we sent you. But it's more insulting to their base than that because not long after that, he messaged out, missing friend, we're meeting with President Trump in 4 hours to show him the impeachment hearing donor list, get in the list. So supposedly, he showed Trump a list of donors at 6:30 p.m. Eastern time. Then they met up at midnight that night to show him another list of donors because what the campaign manager for Trump and Trump do with their time is read thousands of names over and over and over again. And anyone who is on this text message list got the first message and then got the second message. And that should have been enough to clue them in that these people have no respect for you, your time, or your money whatsoever. They think that you are morons and they want to exploit your stupidity for their own financial gain.
Well, you know what? They're working around the clock, Pascal and Trump, to read people's names to him so he can go, they're within my good graces.
Give me, at midnight. Give me more names.
At midnight.
Yeah.
So in the middle of the night, they're reading names because that's just what fuels their fire or their love for the country.
Trump's not reading names at midnight. He's eating donuts and watching Showtime at midnight. Do you know Donald Trump? Do you know who he is?
Definitely tweeting.
And look, I know this is a weird small thing to focus on, but Judd does great work in pointing out this sort of hypocrisy and just like just a complete lack of respect for their own base. And the thing is, I know that very few Trump supporters are probably watching this, but if you are, I want you to know that, look, I'm a progressive. We don't agree on much. I'm not going to give you, for instance, a wall or whatever, like Trump says he will. Hypothetically, I advocate you getting like health insurance and college and stuff like that. But what I will give you that Trump and his campaign will literally never give you is the actual truth. I will be honest to you because, look, I may not agree with much of what you believe politically, but I believe that you as a human have a certain level of just natural dignity and worth, and they clearly do not. Okay, let's take a short break. We come back a little bit more actually on that topic, but this involving Ilhan Omar and the man who threatened to kill her. Earlier this week, a man who threatened to kill Representative Ilhan Omar is facing sentencing now. And Ilhan Omar weighs in, and it's actually fascinating what she says should happen to this man. So to catch you up on this particular case, because you're probably saying, well, aren't there a lot of death threats against these women? Yes, there are, but finally, there are consequences. On Monday, Mr. Carlineo, this is Patrick Carlineo of Addison, New York, outside Buffalo, pleaded guilty to threatening to kill Miss Omar. Just a bit of what he said back in the day was he called in, asked a member of her staff, do you work for the Muslim Brotherhood? Why are you working for her? She's a blank terrorist. Somebody ought to put a bullet in her skull. Back in the day, our forefathers would have put a bullet in her expletive. I'll put a bullet in her expletive skull. So it was a little bit repetitive there. Now, in an interview with the FBI at his home about a week after that call, he described himself as a patriot who loved Mr. Trump and hated, quote, radical Muslims in our government. He told an FBI agent that he believed Ms. Omar supported Islamic militant groups such as Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood, and that her election to Congress was illegitimate. I mean, he could have heard about that stuff, those theories, anywhere. Who knows who could have possibly clued him into that. But it wasn't just a call, it was the fear that he might act out on it. Because about a week later, authorities found a loaded 45 caliber handgun, 3 rifles, 2 shotguns, and hundreds of rounds of ammunition at his home. Because of a 1998 felony conviction, he was legally prohibited from owning a firearm.
All rules that many people in our government would disagree with him having to be held under.
Exactly. I mean, he did his time, I guess. Why can't he own a gun? And so what if, you know, he's listening to crazies that are telling him that simply because she is a Muslim, she's some sort of threat to America on some level. And he clearly believed it, called her up to threaten her, and just happened to have the firearms to make good on his threat. Well, in any event, he faces up to 10 years in prison. Right now, he's free under conditions that include a curfew and restrictions on travel. But in advance of his actual sentencing, Representative Ilhan Omar put out a letter to the judge in this case. She tweeted saying, "Sharing my full letter on the sentencing, a man convicted of threatening my life. We must apply a system of compassion to criminal justice. Who are we as a nation if we respond to threats of political retribution with retribution ourselves?" And she goes on in this letter, which you can find in full on her Twitter account, to say, "The answer to hate is not more hate, it is compassion. Punishing the defendant with a lengthy prison sentence or a burdensome financial fine would not rehabilitate him. It would not repair the harm he has caused. It would only increase his anger and resentment." And she quoted Nelson Mandela, who once said, "People must learn to hate, and if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love." She ended by pleading with the judge, "I ask you to show compassion in your sentencing." That's amazing.
It's pretty amazing. And although all the things that she said are true, there's backups with Nelson Mandela quotes and and the way we need to apply a system of compassion or justice because these are humans, and it's lovely. Those are lovely words. They make me feel good inside, but she's completely wrong. I mean, she's a better person than I am. Okay, not that she's wrong. She's not wrong, because I already said that she's right. I
so just you're siding
completely
with the
disagree
other guy.
With her.
No, okay.
That's
yes.
all. I just 100% disagree with her on this approach to this particular thing. And I, again, not to not do it, but that's not how I want to operate for personally myself.
Mm-hmm. What would you have advised her to
do? We have a history of going after people and putting them away even when they haven't done anything that's egregious. So cool, it's okay if you don't want to. But we also have this system where it's still the case where we're trying to deter people from doing something in the future. So if we don't look to deter them from doing this, then we're gonna just deter certain people that we choose to deter, and then we'll be lenient on people like this. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's gonna solve any problems either. Again, she's a better person than I am, and it's actually an honorable position to take. It's a position that I'm not honorable enough to agree with.
You know, it's really interesting because I feel the same way. She's a better person than me, and she made me agree with her, I think. I would not have, I don't think that she necessarily had to get involved at all. Mm-hmm. And you know, I take these sorts of threats really seriously. I take political violence super seriously. I would argue more than the vast majority of people in media. I think most people are underrating how much of a threat this actually is. But if she believes, as the vast majority of progressives do, that our criminal justice system, our prison system, should be changed from its longstanding horrendous standard operating procedures based around making either the actual victims or the believed victims feel better about a conviction or something like that, just you know, retribution against the people that committed crimes, to something more humane that also has the cool side effect of actually stopping, you know, recidivism, you know, in the way that places like Norway and other countries like that do. If you actually believe that, then why not start with the case that directly involves you? And she's putting her criminal justice money where her mouth is and saying, even at the risk of my own life, I am going to stick with my philosophy in this.
And it's cool. So by the way, my my read on her saying, "I ask you to show compassion in your sentencing," as she said to the judge, I took that to mean a lesser sentence. Maybe it means something else. Maybe compassion and sentencing.
I think she believes, like, I think it was community service and things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, so a lesser sentence.
Yeah.
So my assumptions apparently were correct. Mm-hmm. If it goes to maybe rehabilitation, as you said, to keep recidivism coming down. But there's rehabilitation versus leniency. So if you want to rehabilitate him, cool. I'm not just looking for punishment. He can go to jail and get beat up or whatever, whatever. But what's the rehab process versus this leniency? Yeah. Leniency isn't going to rehab him and teach him the love that Nelson Mandela told you. You need to teach him versus the hate that his parents probably taught him, or that his daddy, Donald Trump, taught him.
I just want to finally say, if we lived in anything even approaching a reasonable, rational society, this letter that she sent, like, conservatively hundreds of thousands, millions of Americans who believe that she's some sort of enemy of America would read that letter and think, I have been led so far astray. This is so much more compassionate. Remember the book that I say that I love, the Bible? This is influenced by that sort of loving philosophy far more than the, you know, lock them up, toss away the key, and, you know, maybe electrocute them philosophy of the people that say that they love the Bible. Like, the fact that so few people actually read this, so few people will be convinced by it, that is really disheartening. But whether we agree with the strategy or not, she's a good human being,
absolutely,
at the very least.
We absolutely can agree on that.
Yes, and that is consistent with other things that she's done and said. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, a little bit more to close out the show. Hollywood is no stranger to some really unfortunate at times casting choices, including Scarlett Johansson playing an Asian character in Ghost of the Shell and Emma Stone playing an Asian character in Aloha. But to this, in comes Harriet. So the screenwriter for Harriet, Gregory Allen Howard, had this to say about his quest to make this movie. He said, "I wanted to turn Harriet Tubman's life, which I'd studied in college, into an action-adventure movie. The climate in Hollywood, however, was very different back then, decades ago. I was told how one studio head said in a meeting, 'This script is fantastic, let's get Julia Roberts to play Harriet Tubman.'" That's not a joke that he's making or that the executive is making. They were serious.
It took me multiple—
Pretty Woman herself.
It took me multiple articles to believe this to be true.
Yeah.
Yesterday when I saw it, I was like, oh, the Onion's at it again.
Uh-huh. Now, that's how we reacted. Mm-hmm. And so apparently even at the time, some people were like, well, that seems weird. And so he goes on to say, Howard said that when someone suggested Roberts could play the role, she could not play the role, the executive responded, "It was so long ago, no one's gonna know the difference." thank you. In case anyone doesn't know what Julia Roberts looks like, yes.
It was so long ago, people might forget that white folks are the ones that were the slave masters and black people.
Well, I knew it was slaves. It was one way or the other.
Yeah.
But by the way, just to be very clear, this was not Julia Roberts' idea. So far as I know, Julia Roberts never even knew about this idea.
Right.
It had nothing to do with Julia Roberts. But Hollywood executives were thinking, you know what? I could see making a Harriet Tubman movie. It is a really inspiring story about one of the greatest Americans of all time. But I'm thinking maybe Kirstie Alley. You know, just get a black actress. They exist. They're trying to find work and they would love to play Harriet Tubman. It's a great challenge to play this dynamic, complicated character. And so look, the good side of this is that finally after decades of effort, the movie gets made and it looks like it's gonna be awesome.
Well, there was a couple of problems. Also, there's one more quote where they're talking about when 12 Years a Slave was a hit, did all this money and Black Panther this. So this is the basis for the reasoning behind this. They're like, well, we don't care if we do things accurately. We just care if it makes us money.
Yes.
Julia Roberts is a name that we can throw around. Who cares? We'll throw her in some blackface and people will come and watch it because it's Julia Roberts. That'll be awesome. Mm-hmm. Not, hey, let's represent this thing correctly and do a film that is not only entertaining, but also is celebratory and informative about what really happened.
Yeah.
No, who cares? First off, it already cringed first off when they said they wanted the Harriet Tubman movie to be an action adventure movie, so she's gonna be the next Marvel character.
Mm-hmm.
But no, just the interest level, if you do it correctly, is interesting enough. But when people have no interest in the subject matter or the characters that actually did the heroic acts, then why would you cast it that way? You don't care about what the person looked like in real life. Why would you care what they look like in your film?
Yeah.
It's about making that money. And Julia Roberts will bring us in some money, not some random black person I've never heard of before.
Well, you know, and the really weird thing too is, ideally, these executives would, like, they would be willing to do these movies without needing the crazy financial incentive to get over their own baked in racism. That would be ideal. That's not the world that we live in. But now there's a number of movies that have shown that these sorts of movies can make tons of money. And so they're a little bit more accepting of it. But it took them so long to come to that conclusion. And the only reason they didn't have a lot more evidence early was because they wouldn't even experiment to find out. And really, think about how powerful a person's racism has to be, that they're willing to delude themselves into losing out on literally billions of dollars over the course of decades just to not do these sorts of movies. That is a powerful motivating force.
And the reason he had that mindset is because this has been done constantly from early film days. They've been doing this up and through current. I had a bunch of lists of them, but you can look up the list of things that were whitewashed. This is a normal thing in Hollywood. So as you, someone says yeah. it, it's not like, oh my God, how dare you say that? They're like, that's the normal process we go with here.
Yeah, yeah. Can't wait to see who they get to play Oprah in a movie about our life or something.
By the way,
Melissa McCarthy plays Oprah.
By the way, I did hear there are some issues with the film, even though they cast, this is a British black woman and there's other things going on, but you can look at that for yourself.
Yes, yes. Not as bad as Julia Roberts. Anyway, thank you as always for joining me. Great to have you here. Thank you everybody for watching. Don't forget to tune in for the main show. Not only will JR be on the main show today, but after that, we of course will have debate commentary. You're not gonna wanna miss it. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.